Hi, I'm Mark Brody, co-host of The Show, one of KJZZ's original productions. It's a program with news and features from across Phoenix and the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode. Good morning. It's The Show here on KJZZ 91.5 in Phoenix. I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Lauren Gilger. Coming up, our Made in Arizona series features a mural artist with a new piece along the light rail.
And why a group in Tucson wants the U of A to end its contract with a controversial company.
But first, Arizona Republican Congressman Paul Gosar and Eli Crane have introduced legislation to do away with two national monuments in Arizona and allow for mining to be reintroduced instead. And environmentalists are not happy about it. The monuments in question are Ironwood Forest National Monument near Tucson and one new one near the Grand Canyon, which was created under the Biden administration just 2 years ago. The move sets up another standoff between environmentalist interests who want to protect these vast lands and mining interests who say they are full of minerals we need to thrive. Joining me from Flagstaff with the latest on this legislation is Fronteras Desk senior editor Michelle Marisco. Good morning there, Michelle.
Hey, good morning, Lauren.
So tell us first, Michelle, where this legislation stands now.
Right. So both pieces were introduced 2 weeks ago, and they have not moved forward yet. Gosar titled these the Northern Arizona Protection Act and the Southern Arizona Protection Act. Gosar wrote that the bills would nullify protections that, in his words, lock up federal lands. And we're going to come back to that phrase lock up later on in this interview.
Right. So his legislation centers around this language, right, of like a missed opportunity. In his words, he says it kind of makes off limits what he deemed as responsible mining and energy development happening in these areas. Now, both of these monuments were protected using the Antiquities Act, Ironwood by President Clinton in 2000 and Bajo Nuevo by President Biden, as we pointed out, just 2 years ago.
Yes. And for example, Baj Nuevo Itacugveni, which protects a vast area from new uranium mining, but not current mining, it's popular with Arizona voters. And that's according to polling that we reported on earlier this year. And among the support for the monument, a voter's voice support for tribal involvement in any decisions affecting protected land.
Gosar's announcements of this legislation never mentions tribes at all.
Correct. And local Republicans support the move. Arizona Senate President Warren Peterson calls the new monument an Obama-Biden land grab that would stop America from producing its own uranium.
Has there been any response yet from the tribes about this effort, Michelle?
You know, in response to have it sued by a tribe, as pointed out, that the tribe is still there. That was their key focus when this legislation came out a few weeks ago. The Havasupai and the Hopi are represented by the Native American Rights Fund, which sought to intervene in the lawsuit called the Arizona State Legislature versus Biden. The U.S. District Court in Arizona denied the tribe's request to intervene. And then in January this year, the U.S. District Court here in Arizona dismissed the lawsuit.
Right. That one's not going to happen. Okay. So, Michelle, give us a broader picture here of what mining looks like right now in Arizona, especially in and around the Grand Canyon, which has been so controversial. These national monuments protected some areas, but there is some mining already happening up there, right? The Pinon Plain Mine.
Yes, the Pinon Plain Mine. So that mine, according to its operator, Energy Fuels, has been very successful. They said just very recently that it's been yielding high-grade uranium. Energy Fuels CEO Mark Chalmers has said recently that the Pinon Plain Mine is the highest-grade uranium deposit mined in the U.S. in the past generation. And he expressed optimism that there's a significant amount of more uranium to extract from that mine.
Okay. Michelle, before I let you go, I want to touch on the other legislation and plans to do away with national monument protections. What do those look like?
Yes. First, I want to touch on Utah Republican Celeste Malloy's legislation, and then that would remove president's authority to designate monuments and gives that authority to Congress. Malloy and co-signers argue that monument designation has become weaponized, and then this uses the same language as GOSAR's legislation. They say that the protections lock up valuable land. And then the Interior Department, the Trump administration, the Washington Post discovered in April that the department plans to scale back at least six monuments, including Bajnoabjo, Itakukveni, and Ironwood.
All right. So that's the latest on there. That is Michelle Marisco joining us, our Fronteras Desk senior editor from Flagstaff. Michelle, thank you so much. Appreciate it.
Thank you. Thank you.
With record investment in the semiconductor industry centered in our state in recent years, in some ways, Arizona's tech sector is booming. But now the industry is sounding the alarm about a new move by the Trump administration aimed at H-1B visas. These are the ones that are given to high-skilled, often tech workers who come from foreign countries. Trump has said employers are abusing the program and taking away American jobs. And now he's slapping a new $100,000 annual fee to all new applications. But our next guest says these are jobs that there aren't enough Americans to fill. Steve Zylstra is the president and CEO of the Arizona Technology Council, and I spoke with him more about it.
Well, it's not good. Obviously, when you have growth, you're hiring talent. And the semiconductor industry is booming. They've had $210 billion invested just in that sector in the last 5 years. And for 15 years, there's been a dearth of talent to fill all the open positions in the technology industry. So this just exacerbates that problem. The Arizona Technology Council and our national organization called the Tech Councils of North America are definitely opposed to this fee.
So what kind of impact do you anticipate seeing locally right off the bat? This is just for new applications, but it seems like most of those visa workers, H-1B visa workers, are employed by Intel here in the Valley. What's the reaction look like there?
Well, first of all, these are very high-skilled positions that are being filled by H-1B applicants. And, you know, especially in the tech industry, those are critical. I would say that it's going to affect our universities and it's going to affect our hospitals as well, because H-1B visas, by the way, are used to bring physicians here from around the world, researchers, scientists, new faculty. So in addition to the tech industry, I think our academic institutions and health and bioscience institutions will be equally affected. A lot of tech companies actually use H-1B visas. Intel is certainly one of them, but ASML, ASM, Microchip, TSMC, companies like that in the semiconductor industry are all also using H-1B visas.
Okay.
It used to be $2,000 to $8,000 fee to get an H-1B, and that was really based on a cost recovery method. What the administration is doing is essentially attaching a toll. This $100,000 is a toll. So I think there's going to be a lawsuit. I think this is probably unlawful, certainly vulnerable in court. So I don't think we've heard the end of it yet.
Let me ask you, I mean, like H-1B visas are mostly given out to kind of the biggest of the big when it comes to tech companies in the country. It's not like they can't afford this fee. Is it more of like the message it's sending to you?
Well, I think this essentially takes smaller entities, small businesses, entrepreneurial businesses out of the game. Because as I said, it used to be, or currently is $2,000 to $8,000 to get an H-1B, and a small company could afford that, but they're not going to be able to afford a $100,000 toll. So I think there's inequity in the way this is going to be applied.
Interesting. Okay. What do you make, Steve, then, of the kind of broader debate that's underlying this fee and the debate over bringing high-skilled workers in from other countries? Like, you're going to hear the Trump administration and many people argue that, you know, we're just letting companies pay less for international talent than they would pay for a worker educated here in the U.S. Is that the way you see it?
No. By the way, there's been decades of research that actually link high-skilled immigration in the U.S. to higher patenting, greater productivity, and more growth. So this is having already the kinds of positive impacts on the U.S. that are critical to the growth of the sector nationally and here in Arizona. So, yeah, I don't agree with that.
I wonder what you make of the other side's argument, right, that this will drive those highly skilled workers, which it sounds like tech companies are often competing over, to just go to another country and kind of help a company there.
I think that's exactly what's going to happen. I think, first of all, it's going to push some jobs offshore and in some cases to our competitors from sort of Canada to China. So I think that's one of the deleterious impacts that this fee will have.
What are you hearing from some of the bigger or even smaller tech companies in the state right now? Are they concerned like you?
Well, as you suggested, you know, this is used, the preponderance of H-1Bs go to the large tech companies and universities and large hospital systems. So it's not going to have, I would say, a significant impact on small businesses and startups. But for those that use them, of course, it will have a dramatic impact.
There seems to be some agreement on both sides, at least, Steve, that the program as it stood needed some kind of reform because the lottery system as it's designed is dominated by those big corporations that get most of these applicants to them. What kind of reform do you think might be helpful if it's not this fee?
Well, there are bad actors like there are in every aspect of our society, right? And I think the rules, the laws, the regulations that are already in place can prevent that. It's just that there hasn't been sufficient enforcement and wage standards and so on to prevent, you know, the bad actors. So I think, you know, maybe we focus on true wage floors, sort of raise and enforce the wage floors and crack down on outsourcing abuses and speed employment-based green cards and modernize the system.
Interesting. Let me ask you lastly, Steve, about the long-term, the potential long-term impact here. I mean, you said, as you suggested, that you anticipate this will end up in court. But if it does go into effect and you've got companies dealing with this kind of fee or talent not wanting to come here, what do you think the long-term impact could be specifically here in Arizona on the tech sector, which is growing a lot right now, as we said?
Yeah, well, I think it'll just make the job of finding top talent more difficult. That's a lot of people. That's a lot of jobs. You know, without that talent, companies aren't going to be able to accomplish the things that they need to accomplish to continue to grow.
Do you think they won't just turn to the equivalent in terms of U.S. workers with the same kind of skills? Do those not exist?
Yeah, there's no proof of that. All the research that's been done basically says that's not true. And what I think will happen is, as I suggested earlier, is they'll outsource some of these jobs. And, you know, we're just not producing enough talent here in the United States. We're not producing enough students at the K through 12 level that are focused on STEM education. And, you know, our post-secondary institutions are producing lots of great talent, but the funnel is not as wide and deep as it should be. So that's one of the reasons we have to search outside of the United States to find the kind of talent to fill the demand.
All right. We'll leave it there. That is Steve Zylstra, president and CEO of the Arizona Technology Council, as well as president and CEO of the SciTech Institute, joining us with reaction to this move from the Trump administration. Steve, thank you for coming on. Appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Lauren Gilger. Coming up, we'll hear from the organizer of Pigeon Palooza, who owns about 150 pigeons.
But first, a company that makes a popular dash camera has been hacked. Nexar refers to its products as an AI driving sidekick and is used by drivers who want video evidence in the event of an accident, as well as rideshare drivers concerned about unruly or violent riders. But as my next guest reports, a hacker was able to access loads of videos from Nexar. Joseph Cox is co-founder of 404 Media, a tech investigations website. He joins me to talk more about this. And Joseph, as you reported, this data is not only being stored, but it was also hacked.
Yeah, so not ideal when you have this dash cam in your vehicle, and maybe it's for your own purposes or whatever. But yes, I reported that a hacker broke into Nexar's systems, and what they were able to do was find terabytes of users' dash cam footage that had been uploaded to the cloud. The reason the hacker was able to do this, they told me within a couple of hours, they compromised the company. They were able to do this without getting too technical, but there's basically a digital key inside every single dash cam. And rather than just allowing that individual dash cam to upload its own footage, the key erroneously could basically view everybody else's footage as well. It could even delete other people's footage as well. So the hacker was able to use that, log in, and see all of this footage collected from people's dash cams all across the United States. And the hacker sent some to me, and, you know, it's sensitive stuff. Obviously, these people did not expect that their conversations probably were being uploaded to a server. They definitely didn't think a hacker would get them. And they absolutely didn't think a hacker would then provide, you know, their private footage to a journalist as well.
Yeah. So, I mean, it seems like there are clearly some privacy concerns, but as you report, there are also some potential national security concerns in terms of where some of these drivers were taking passengers.
Yeah, the hack by itself would already be a story, of course, but going through the data, the hacker was able to find that one of these people kept driving towards the entrance of the Central Intelligence Agency, and they managed to bring up a few videos. And at one point, it shows the person clearly taking their dash camera off the dash and then hiding it, presumably because they're driving to a sensitive location. But then in another case, it seems that they didn't remember to do that. And I've seen the video where this person is driving, you know, pretty close up to the entrance to the CIA. Now, do our adversaries already know what the CIA looks like? I imagine so. But yeah, this is not, it's not ideal that this data and these images were uploaded to a server that then was apparently very vulnerable to hackers as well.
So what was the hacker trying to do here? What was their motivation for busting into this information and sharing it with you?
So hackers' motivations can be somewhat complicated, but in this case, it appears that they saw I wrote an article about Nexar before. After that, the hacker contacted me and said, oh, I've actually already broken into Nexar because I found this very serious vulnerability, and I was thinking of doing a responsible disclosure. And that is where the hacker basically tells a company, hey, there's something wrong with your systems, you should fix it. Now, companies don't always respond when hackers reach out to them. So, you know, in my more than 10 years of doing this, it is very common that hackers will come to me because they believe the company is much more likely to fix the issue if a journalist contacts them as well. Now, of course, this person probably still broke the law. They still went in and they did hack these systems. But in their eyes, they're doing it to protect people. They're doing it to get this issue fixed. And Nexar did fix the vulnerability after I contacted them for comment.
Yeah, I was curious about what Nexar's response was. It sounds like they fixed it. Did they seem aware of the fact that this was an issue?
They didn't seem aware. Well, let me rephrase that ever so slightly. So yeah, I reach out. I tell Nexar about it. Over the few days that it took to report this story, they do fix the issue. After publication, I'm actually contacted by another security researcher who I already have a relationship with, and they said they'd actually already warned Nexar a week or so before that. Mm. So clearly, they should have known about it, or potentially could have known about it, but it was only after I contacted them that they actually fixed the issue.
Well, so do users of these dash cams know that they're video that their data is going to be stored on a server somewhere? Like, is that part of the agreement that they make when they put one of these in their cars?
So there's a second part to this story, which is that as well as the hack, there is this public map that you can just go look at on Nexar's website. It's publicly available, and it has images from its users' dash cams. And they do this because Nexar also sells that data. They basically use AI to identify road signs, traffic, that sort of thing, and then they sell it to companies such as Google. Now, again, that's a public map. And it has images taken from people's dash cams. I then reached out to, I think, 4 or 5 different Nexar dash cam users. And the 3 or so who got back to me said they had no idea that this map existed. They had no idea that they have this small camera in their car and it's surreptitiously uploading this data to a public map. That's already bad enough. And then the Nexar users I spoke to obviously also did not know that the company had been hacked.
Did Nexar, have they said anything about how they will, obviously they fixed the specific vulnerability that the hacker and the other security expert had found, but have they said anything about maybe changing their notifications or maybe not having that public map anymore or maybe trying to do something to better protect all this video and all this data?
Nexar haven't said anything to me about changing the data side of their business, about changing this publicly available map. I think for them, it is probably a sizable part of their business. This hacker also managed to obtain a PDF which laid out some of the other companies which have interacted with Nexar in some form about potentially buying this data. And there are companies like Microsoft in there, Google, Apple, even Niantic, which is the maker of the mobile game Pokemon Go.
Yeah.
You can see why these companies would probably want traffic or vehicle or camera data. I can't imagine Nexar is in a rush to stop that side of its business. If it believes it's already, you know, disclosed enough to the users, just the users I spoke to really had no idea.
Yeah. I wonder, like, not to be too cynical here, but is it too far of a stretch to, like, if you buy one of these, to assume that the video is going to end up, the data is going to end up somewhere that maybe you'd rather it not?
I think that's a risk with every application or device that we use nowadays. And honestly, it is exhausting as an ordinary consumer to figure out, oh, I've just bought this new piece of tech. What do I have to worry about now? Yeah. I do this every single day as well. That being said, even if you assume, oh, my dash cam footage is being uploaded somewhere, I don't think customers should, or they shouldn't have to assume it's going to be posted on a public map or it's going to be vulnerable to hackers. We all know the data is going to exist somewhere, but I don't think we should, you know, give up and just assume that, oh, hackers will get this at some point. That being said, the person driving to the CIA clearly knew there was some sort of issue, which is why he kept taking the camera off his dash and hiding it in his car. So he knows there's something there.
All right. That is Joseph Cox, co-founder of 404 Media. Joseph, good to talk to you. Thank you.
Absolutely. Take it easy.
A social justice group based in Tucson is calling on the University of Arizona to end its contract with Flock Safety. That's the company that makes license plate readers that's gained attention recently for its sharing of data with law enforcement agencies. A recent investigation by 404 Media, from whom we just heard, found that data was being used for immigration-related enforcement, even though the feds do not have a contract with Flock. Prerna Sanap Navar, higher education reporter with the Arizona Daily Star, has written about this. She joins me now to talk about U of A's role in this controversy. Prerna, good morning.
Good morning, Mark. Thank you for having me on the show.
Thank you for being here. So what is the situation at the U of A? How many of these license plate readers does U of A have on its campus?
According to the contract that the U of A has with Flock Safety, there's about 62 Flock Safety products, but the community organization that is leading this campaign, Desert Rising, actually states that there's 54 specific cameras. So there's 54 cameras across the U of A campus.
And am I right that this is a fairly new development at the U of A? Like, these haven't been there all that long.
Yes. So according to the contract, the U of A started with Flock Safety in February of this year, and the contract is going to last for about 5 years. And the UFA is investing about $160,000 per annum into these products. So for 5 years, that's going to be about $800,000.
Okay. So what does Desert Rising say? Like, what is their opposition to having these cameras, having these license plate readers around campus?
So I think the several community organizations, obviously it started with Desert Rising, but there's other community organizations like UA Resist and United Campus Workers Arizona as well. I think their concern is that this isn't just about safety. This is about surveillance because, you know, the automated license plate readers that Flock Safety supplies, they record everything. It's not just the license plate, you know, the make and model of the car, the if the car has any stickers, any, you know, kind of like the color of it. So all of that is being recorded, even if it's not a camera that's recording faces. So I think that surveillance, especially now in the current time where there's so much, you know, heavy, intense immigration stuff happening, even at the UFA campus where there were so many student visa revocations, which happened, and obviously Tucson has also seen immigration-related stuff. So in the midst of all of this, this additional surveillance is something that they're worried about.
Have the groups specifically said that they're worried about immigration-related activity?
Yes, they did say that. And I think the UFA's response has kind of been like, you know, we're still looking at safety. The University of Arizona Police Department Chief Chris Olson, he also said that, you know, we're using the data that Flock Safety collects for misdemeanor and felony offenses for investigating stuff like that, and also said that the data is deleted after 30 days. But I think one of the other things that the community organizations are worried about is that the UFA did not explicitly give out this information to the community. So there's also confusion. There is, you know, not enough information about exactly where the information is being shared with how many agencies. And, you know, just I think they just want to know more. And that is also something where they're saying that it violates civil rights.
Well, so you say that the groups want to learn more. Is the U of A being forthcoming about this information? Like, have they said anything to address the critics' concerns about these cameras being used in immigration enforcement?
Yes, I think beyond stating the reasons for which this information is being used, you know, misdemeanor and felony offenses, beyond that, I think the UFA and UAPD have said that, you know, this the information that Flock Safety collects is not going to be shared with any local, state, or federal law enforcement agencies without the UFA's permission or without a court order. But what they did not clarify is if there was any prior approval given by the UFA or UAPD to any other agencies, or if there was any other court order which gives them that access as well. So that hasn't been clarified.
So, Prerna, I'm hoping you might be able to put this into the national context. As I mentioned in the introduction, that this company has been fairly controversial, not just in Arizona, but all over the place for similar kinds of things that folks in Tucson are concerned about. How does this story fit into sort of that national context?
Mm-hmm, sure. So when 404 Media came out with its investigation in May, the kind of information that came out was, I think, concerning and controversial because what the investigation showed is that there's been about 4,000 nation and statewide lookups across the country by local and state police, which was done either at the behest of the federal government or as a quote-unquote informal favor to federal law enforcement. And in the Flock Safety, you know, database, when someone does a search, there's this field called the reason field where the person has to put in the reason for why the search is being done. And the answers which were found by 404 Media were, you know, immigration or ICE, which is Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE plus ERO, which is ICE's Enforcement and Removal Operations section, which focuses on deportations. And 404 Media also found that while these searches involving ICE were made during both the Biden and the Trump administrations, searches which explicitly stated the reasons as immigration were made mostly during since January, since President Donald Trump was inaugurated.
Interesting. All right. That is Prerna Sanapnavar, higher education reporter with the Arizona Daily Star. Prerna, thanks so much. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
Good morning. It's the show here on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Lauren Gilger. And now let's meet the next maker in our series, Made in Arizona.
I could take risk with embroidery in a way that I couldn't take risks in other areas of art.
A lot of my paintings, gravity doesn't matter a whole lot. dance wasn't something that is necessarily seen in galleries, you know? And I just remember being like, this is the key. This is how dance gets out there.
I try to tug at people's heartstrings and try to do something disturbing.
I escaped real life and I went back in time.
Rae Wilson's murals and paintings are full of life and color. She calls it imaginative nature. In her latest work and largest ever, she's painted a mural that's wrapped around the Roosevelt and Central Avenue light rail station called Travelers. It's part of her work as ArtLink Phoenix's Fall 2025 Spotlight Artist, and it features the top half of five of her friends' faces. You can see the smile in their eyes, as she described it. Above their heads are birds. A quail, an owl, a cactus wren, a raven. It's realistic and abstract at once, and it celebrates the desert, even for a transplant from the Midwest. I spoke with her more about the mural, but first, she told me how she got here.
My mom put me in these Bob Ross-sponsored oil painting classes when I was 10 years old. And so that's my first experience of painting, and I picked it back up in, like, 2015. I had left college. I dropped out. I was studying interior architecture and I was bored to tears. And when I got back home to my childhood bedroom, I found old canvases and paint. So I just picked it right back up. And so for the past, I guess, 10 years, I would say I've been extremely consistent and really fallen in love with it.
And you've had, you know, internships, partnerships, lots of fellowships, your artist in residencies, yeah. Like all of these things that to grow yeah. your work here. How did you end up in Arizona?
I had a lot of seasonal depression living in Chicago. It was just too cold for too long. And I kind of had my eye on a few different places that might be more weather friendly for me. And Arizona was one of those places on the list. And so during COVID, I happened to meet my now spouse online who lived here in Phoenix. And I was like, okay, now I have a reason to visit. And I visited for a week. And after a week, I was like, oh, I think I can do this. And so 8 months later, I was here. And now it's been 4 years.
Wow. Okay. So being a transplant, it sounds like pops up in your work a little bit in terms of yeah. subject matter. In what way does it come out? Like, how do you think about your role here as a transplant in the desert?
I feel like I have some sort of responsibility to represent many identities and many, like, facets of the world. Mm-hmm. When I first moved to Arizona, maybe in, like, the first couple of weeks, I was like, oh, no, maybe I made a mistake. I felt like it was really difficult to meet people because of how spread out things were, and like it kind of seemed like everyone was already in their social groups, and it felt really challenging just to kind of be integrated in community. And I was like looking for other people who had similar stories as me, like people who come from other places, people of various identities. And as an artist, if I have like the ability to speak about like what it's like to be new in a space or to reinvent yourself, I'm always looking to do that in my work.
Yeah, I like that. Do you feel like you've been able to reinvent yourself here?
Maybe not reinvent, but maybe refine.
Okay.
I feel like being here has really grown me in a way. I think that struggle of looking for community kind of forced me into building it and to fostering it. Yeah. And I feel like I do that in the ways that I teach art classes in a lot of different spaces around the city, and I lead sketching tours. And I just feel like I am constantly looking to make people feel like they're at home.
Yeah. 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 That's a good way to make yourself feel at home, I'm sure.
Yeah, it works.
So let me ask you a little bit about your process. One of the things I read that you like to do in your process is painting through all of the phases of a piece, like layering it on a canvas. Yeah. Describe how that works and what it does to the final product.
Yeah. All of my paintings start extremely loose. I like to start more of with an idea and less of like a hard copy sketch. I sometimes will work from photographs and I'll combine like one or more photographs. And my only goal is to get the main subject in there. And then I'm kind of letting the background develop itself. I'm happy to make mistakes all along the way. Usually a lot of artists will work like background to foreground, but I'm usually like foreground to background. Mm-hmm. And in that way, like, the piece really does develop itself. There are all these brushstrokes that were like, oh, I shouldn't have done that, or that was unintentional, or maybe that color is too strong. But because I am also limiting how much I am erasing things, it leaves a little bit of a piece of everything that I've done in each painting. And so what ends up coming out is something that looks a little bit surreal or just kind of wonky. And I'm happy with it. I'm like, okay, this is fine, because it's telling a story. It's like, you know, appreciating the journey to this final piece.
Yeah, I like that. I like that. You often use circles in your work and kind of other geometric shapes at times, yeah, too. Why is that?
Well, that also started as an accident. my first use of the circle was to cover up an area that I was unhappy with. But then that circle kind of connected two spaces on the canvas. It was, again, a cactus painting. This is before I ever moved to Arizona. I was painting a cactus. And when I put the circle behind it, it kind of connected the background and the cactus together. And I thought, wow, that was really cool. Like, I think I can do that on purpose. And so now anytime I feel like there's any sort of like empty space or just dead space on the canvas where I'm like, I don't know, this section doesn't look very good, or maybe it needs something, mm-hmm, a circle has never failed me. Mm-hmm. And I feel like that circle of just like creating the connection really like speaks to, I think, what I'm trying to convey in my work is that everything is sort of circular and things do come back around. And it's kind of just my life mantra is that everything is a circle.
Everything is a circle. I like that.
Yeah.
You obviously use a lot of nature. Your portraiture is in there a lot. Yeah. I saw the phrase imaginative nature when I was reading about you. What does that look like?
Yeah. At some point I just start making it up. I like to, yeah. So I'll look at a reference photo and I'll like, okay, yeah, this is a good start. And then at some point it just becomes, I don't know, just this totally like, this is not exactly the reference photo. So I'll play around with the colors. Like if it's a lime green, I'm like, I don't know, maybe this should be blue green instead. Or I just really allow myself so much space and just a lot of grace to work with my mistakes in my artwork.
I mean, it kind of makes you think about the definition of a mistake in art, right? Like, is it really a mistake?
Yeah, no. And there's this great quote, and I don't know who said it, but it's, art is about the mistakes that you keep. And I tell my students that all the time. Like, that's 100% right. Like, just try it out. If it doesn't work, you can probably use some part of it at least. And so I really try to stick with that.
Yeah. Okay. So let me ask you lastly then, Ray, what you want to do with this? Like, it sounds like you plan on being in Phoenix for some time at least and making your mark here. Where do you want to take your career?
I have a really big heart for community and art being accessible. And so I have a really big dream of fostering that in some way. So like, I don't know, like community art workshops that are like low barriers to entry, storytelling workshops for people who have like complex stories to tell. In some way, I just really want to be really well integrated in my community and be able to lead art in a way that gives people a voice to their own stories. I don't really know what that looks like right now, or I guess how to get there. But that is what I want to do. I just want to share art with community.
It sounds like you're well on your way. All right, we'll leave it there. That is Ray Wilson, an artist in Phoenix. ArtLink, Phoenix's Fall 2025 Spotlight Artist. Her latest mural is at the Central and Roosevelt Light Rail Station. Ray, thank you so much for coming on. I appreciate it.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Good morning. It is the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger.
And I'm Mark Brody. This coming Saturday marks the first ever Pigeonpalooza in Snowflake, Arizona. Pigeonpalooza is, well, exactly what it sounds like, a festival of all things pigeon. It is partly the brainchild of Philip Fry, who runs a nonprofit called All About Pigeons. Fry says he originally became fascinated by pigeons when he started researching doves and discovered that the birds we often call doves are actually a type of pigeon called the white homer.
I always thought when they did a white dove release, you know, they're just increasing the white dove population in this area, but nope, they're all white homers.
So doves are technically pigeons?
Right, yeah, and pigeons are doves. Yep.
Fry quickly found himself immersed in the world of pigeon fancying, as it's known in the birding world. It's a time-honored tradition, and to learn more about it, Fry launched a podcast, also called All About Pigeons, where he interviews academics and fellow fanciers about a range of topics like training pigeons for racing and performance, pigeons' role in U.S. military history, and designing an ideal pigeon loft. As Fry told our co-host Sam Dingman, he also began amassing his own flock of birds.
So, you know, I got the white homers, and then I got some regular, like, racing style homing pigeons, and then I got into some fancy different breeds and stuff like that. There's so many different breeds, and when you start looking at the different breeds, some breeds just really call to people the way they look and
sure.
the striking colors and stuff like that.
Do you find that they have different personalities?
They really do. There's over 600 different breeds mm-hmm. of pigeons, and some people even say more than that. The way that they come in different shapes and sizes, it's incredible. So you can find one that'll really stick out to you, and, you know, because they breed so much and so fast that you can really control and pick certain traits and stuff. And, you know, you get some breeds that, like, the parlor rollers that roll on the ground, or the Birmingham rollers that do somersaults in the air. It's really incredible.
Wow. Well, I have in my notes here that you have a pigeon that does fortune telling. Is this accurate?
Yeah, that's right. I've got him trained to a point now where, you know, I give him a command with a light, and he can draw a fortune slip, and he drops it down a tube for us, and we pull it out of the tube. So now we got a fortune telling pigeon. Or if you have an event, he can also draw raffle tickets for you.
That's fantastic. Does he have a name?
Yeah, it's Gurkha, the fortune-telling pigeon.
Okay, all right. So pigeons are obviously a very maligned and misunderstood bird. There's a lot of people who hate pigeons. They call them rats of the sky and all these things I know you're very familiar with. But one of the things that I know is important to you is talking about aspects of pigeons that a lot of people might not be aware of that might make them appreciate them more, and not just that, you know, Gurkha can help tell fortunes. For example, you've talked about the role that pigeons have played during wartime.
Yeah, and that goes back as long as we can go back and track down, like, our written history. We're writing and talking about pigeons. Even if it was just for an agriculture purpose of, you know, birds that will fly around, get their own food and water, and then you can have a source of meat and eggs. And then we start to recognize that homing abilities have a purpose in wartime for sending messages. My great uncle Junior, he was actually part of the Pigeon Signal Corps, and he was one of the people that served and worked with the training of the pigeons. And there were 32 medals of honor given to pigeons. G.I. Joe saved over 1,000 people's lives just by being able to communicate a message to stop a bombing in Shir Ami.
G.I. Joe was the name of a pigeon, to be clear.
G.I. Joe was the name of the pigeon, yes. Uh-huh. Yeah, and that was a pigeon that saved over 1,000 people in a city in Italy.
Would you be able to explain for people who have maybe, you know, heard the phrase homing pigeon or carrier pigeon and are kind of ambiently aware of pigeons being able to deliver messages? How does that actually work? What exactly are they capable of doing?
It's kind of interesting, really, because it's still kind of a mystery even today. And there's universities that have done all kinds of studies. They've put eye caps on the pigeons to see if it's a visual thing. Is it a smell thing? You know, the most common belief is that it's something to do with magnetic fields.
Huh.
However, they've also correlated, like, during massive solar events that pigeons get a little bit more disoriented.
Hmm.
But whenever the pigeon, wherever it's born, right, that's going to be its spot where it's always going to want to go back to.
Okay.
So even if you have a pigeon born in your loft and you try to move it around to different lofts, it's always going to want to kind of mess around and go back to that one loft,
huh.
even if it's only 20 feet away. It's really peculiar about that. So the original kind of keeping of pigeons was they would build these big dovecotes, which were just kind of like structures made out of clay usually and stuff like this. And the pigeons would go and fly, and they would get their own food and water and come back. And then the pigeon fanciers at that time would just harvest the squab for meat, and then they would get eggs and fertilizer for their fields. And so by recognizing that these pigeons would always home back, you know, then they would just start recognizing that if I'm traveling and this guy has a dovecote, I have a dovecote. We would meet in the middle. I would give him some of my pigeons. I would take some of his. And then whenever we needed to communicate, you know, they could just put a message on that pigeon and they could communicate because that pigeon would always fly back to that dovecote.
The pigeon would just know how to get back to the right place it came from.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So that's what homing pigeon means, is that the pigeon right. is going home?
Right, yeah.
And we don't understand how they're able to do that.
Yeah, there is no clear, concise agreement on it yet.
What do you find are some of the reasons that people get interested in pigeons?
There's kind of like two people that are into pigeons, and it's either, I would call it royalty, right? So you were born into it, like your parents had pigeons right. and their parents had pigeons, and, uh-huh. and it's the royalty chain, or they got introduced to pigeons and it just clicks with people, you know, that when they see a pigeon, a fancy breed or whatever, they get a hold of a pigeon, or someone does a pigeon release and they get to see all these pigeons fly and learn about how they're coming back home. It just, it really hits with people and it just hooks them in. Mm-hmm. And when you get that pigeon bug, it's a really hard thing to shake, and I'll tell you.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you've also talked, if I'm not mistaken, about the way that pigeons can have sort of a calming effect.
Right. Yeah, absolutely.
What do you mean by that?
Yeah. It's definitely the cooing, you know, the cooing itself, the pigeon cooing, that is a very calming effect. But when you're holding pigeons, you know, if stressful day or I'm always angry and then I go out of my pigeon loft and then it just calms down. Hmm. They have this calming effect. It's really hard to describe, but especially if you're in a big situation, like inside of a loft of pigeons mm-hmm. and just surrounded by the cooing. And, you know, that's, you know, they've been called the bird of peace for, you know, thousands of years. And maybe that's a big part of it.
Right. I mean, doves, right? We think of doves as like the symbol right. of peace.
Absolutely. Yeah.
There's something very lovely about that.
I mean, so pigeons, you know, they inhabit every continent except Antarctica. Mm-hmm. Like they are survivors, you know, when it comes to balance with nature, like they find a way. You know, Darwin, he loved pigeons, you know, the mm-hmm. fact that, mm-hmm. you know, his whole thing, you know, he gets misquoted a lot, you know, about survival of the fittest. It's survival of the most adaptable to change.
Well, as a last question for you, Philip, mm-hmm. at Pigeonpalooza, you're going to have this pigeon cooing competition. Do you have a pigeon cooing impression that you do?
So my cooing isn't very good. So what I do is, because there's a lot of different sounds that they make, actually. Uh-huh. I'm going to try to do, this is my impression of a cockbird, like a powder cockbird approaching a female. So it'd be like a,
That sounds recognizably pigeon-esque to me.
Yeah, pigeon-esque. That's what I was going for. I keep the bar low because, you know, I want to make someone else win that trophy.
Well, Philip Fry is the host of the All About Pigeons podcast, the owner of about 150 pigeons of his own, and will be putting on Pigeonpalooza in Snowflake on October 4th. Philip, thank you for this conversation.
Oh, thanks so much for having me on, Sam. I really appreciate it.
Thoughts on pigeons, Lauren?
I mean, generally, I lived in New York City for some time and did not like them.
So you're very familiar with them.
That conversation made me change my mind a little bit. I should give it a shot.
Maybe head up to Pigeonpalooza this weekend.
It sounds like a blast.
All right, that'll do it for this Tuesday edition of the show. Thank you, as always, for being along. Remember, sign up for the show's weekly newsletter. It is called Radioheads. You can sign up at theshow.kjzz.org. For Lauren Gilger and Sam Dingman, I'm Mark Brody in Phoenix. Have a great rest of your day. Hope to have you right back here tomorrow.